This is the Dungeon Master Guys. Dungeon Master Guys.
Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Dungeon Master Guide. I'm your host, ChatTDM, along with Dave. Hey Dave, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great.
Have you seen Newbie?
I've seen him before, but I think he got attacked by gnolls or something.
Or he locked himself in the dungeon again.
Yeah.
Oh well, we'll just have to go. Yeah, maybe both. We'll have to go without him.
Yeah, four episodes. That's like a fiscal quarter. That's a pretty important milestone, right?
Yeah. I'm actually impressed, and we're still having fun, so I look forward to do at least four more.
Exactly.
All right, so what's on the program today?
We're going to start with Newbie DM segment on railroading and his method for trying to avoid that.
Yeah, I'll follow up with my own segment where I discuss different ways to keep focus of your players or immerse your players at the game table.
And then I've got a segment about running a flashback game in order to mix it up and give your players a chance to play a different character than the one they're playing in the long-running campaign.
Cool. Then we'll answer two emails we got over the last few weeks. And we'll end up the show with discussing our Gen Con plans. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting year at Gen Con.
I agree. Lots of stuff going on.
All right. So before we go on to our features, let's hear it from our sponsors, Obsidian Portal.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
So railroading is a dirty word among some DMs, and for others, it's the way to go. Well, Newbie DM's got his own take on the situation, how you can avoid the kind of classic railroad mistakes, but make it into something manageable. So take it away.
All right, so I want to talk to you today about something I call the Newbie Railroad. One of the pitfalls I discovered in my early days as a DM was the tendency to railroad or lead my players on a track right into a storyline that I thought I needed them to follow. This, my friends, is not a good thing. Players want to have free will. They don't want to feel like their choices are either limited or of just no consequence. Your job then as a DM is to provide them with this free will, or at least the illusion of free will. It's not that difficult to accomplish, and your players will appreciate you more. So let's assume your players throw you for a loop in your campaign, and they take a path you hadn't thought of. Let's create a story here. Let's assume your adventure called for the party to find a priest of Pelor who supposedly lives somewhere beyond the Howling Woods. They need to find this priest because he holds a special sunlight ritual that a local farming community needs him to cast due to endless rain. Alright, so you've created your map, you have it all planned out, and you know that the priest resides in the village of Eastwood. And you hope that the players stumble there eventually because it's the largest village on your map. But your players look at the map and decide to check out other spots instead. They want to go to a town called Evans Landing, and then on to the Howling Woods. So what do? Well, you have a few options. One, you can make things fit. And this may be the simplest solution of them all, and the least obvious to the players. Whatever you had planned in Eastwood, just adapt it to happen in Evans Landing. The players wouldn't really know the difference anyway. Unless you had a really good reason to keep your priest in the original location, this shouldn't be a problem. Your players have the illusion of free will, and your story can continue on its path. Another thing you could do is just go with their flow. So the players have decided to go to Evans Landing, but you really want the priest to live in Eastwood. No problem, let him go to Evans Landing. It turns out that a few farmers here have on rainy days actually used the ritual from a priest in Eastwood. You can use the new location to your advantage. The farmers are willing to tell the party where the priest is if they help us out with something first, they say. The players will feel as if their free will contributed to their advancement in the storyline, as if they were supposed to go to Evans Landing and they figured it out. You can also wing it. The players have decided that they are not only going to take their time in finding the priest, They want to explore a bit of the world you've laid out in front of them. We're going to go to the Howling Woods and look for evidence of werewolves. We'll deal with the priest later, they tell you. You're like, what? Your instinct will tell you that it's easier to say, you find no evidence of werewolves, rather than letting them do what they want. This is really wrong. You don't want to do that. In fact, this branching out can lead to greater plot hooks in the future that you may want to have in your back pocket. It can also lead your story back on track. So let's assume the players investigate the werewolves. Maybe they find a young werewolf with ties to Eastwood. He might be carrying a map of the village, or a note explaining his curse. The note says, "Help me, I'm Harlan from the village of Eastwood. Take my corpse to my mother and beg her to forgive me and my curse." Use the party's ideas and choices to open up story opportunities for your campaign. Regroup your thoughts. Not everyone can be creative all the time. If your party really throws a curveball your way, it's always fair to tell them, "Guys, give me a few minutes to gather my thoughts. Take a break. Come up with something." Sometimes it's a lot of pressure to sit there at the table with a bunch of eyes looking at you while you're trying to think of something. So be honest. Tell them, "Listen, I gotta get up. Let's take a break. You guys threw me for a loop. Let me take five and think of something real quick." One last thing is that preparation is key. A good idea when dealing with these kinds of situations is to prepare and plan for them ahead of time. One way to do this is to have a flowchart or a mind map prepared, with all the possible branches you think your players may take, and the options you'd have available to confront them. Flowcharts and mind maps can help you organize the many paths you can expect your players to take into a cohesive document for yourself. So in closing, don't allow your players' actions to be game stoppers for you. They are entitled to and should be able to make decisions. This is not a video game, and it's not on a track. So let the players take off on their path, and just be sure you're prepared to deal with it. Remember, get your players off of your newbie railroad. Now let's go back to the DM's table with Phil and Dave.
Of course, Dave, you know, experienced DMs like us would never use role writing, right? Yeah. Or if we do, we don't actually call it like that.
It's a linear-based plot line. It's much fancier.
I really like the approach. I think I saw it in Newbie mentions it, and I think Robin Laws mentions it. It's one of the approach when you really don't have a lot worked out, where the players decide to go, they've got two choices, and whatever they decide to go, whatever was planned is going to happen. I think there's a specific name for that.
The illusion of choice is what I've seen it referred to as several times.
Yeah, well, as long as you don't overdo it.
Yeah.
Or brag about it. Which brings me to my segment where I give a few tips to DMs about helping their players keep focused or get immersed at the gaming table, a list of do's and a list of don'ts. So why don't we listen to that? When I look back at over 30 years of RPG sessions, I pinpoint a few of our games that were especially successful. And when I analyze them through the lens of experience, I noticed that what they all had in common were games where the players and the GM were especially focused in what was happening around the table. Now, in more serious games, that focus became immersion. In less serious games, that focus was more about the camaraderie around the table. And, you know, in the in-between games, it was mostly focusing on either the story or the action going on at the table. But our concentration kept being constant most of the game. So I thought it'd be interesting to discuss how to help your group reach that particular focus with a series of do's and don'ts that I would comment. So let's start with the do's. One of the things that I've noticed really helps a gaming group get into game story really fast is for the GM to use short, vivid descriptions of the surrounding, of the NPC appearances and their action. If you use strong adjectives like "The axe crazy barbarian charges you before he chops you off with his axe," will help the target player be much more focused about what's going to happen. A very easy trick to do is to use voices for your NPCs. Now, I know it feels silly, and there's a chance that your players will snigger once you start doing it for the first few times, but after some point, they'll grow used to it. I have an experience at Gen Con a few years ago. I was playing a D&D 4E game with one of the game designers, and the adventure was a normal dungeon delve with kobolds defending the entry to a deeper dungeon. And as soon as we came in the room, he started, "Dah!"
Hey, no, you can't invade my room. I will kill you with my spear.
Which, yes, it does sound silly, but it really put me into the scene and gave me the impression that I was surrounded by squeaky lizard thingies. So that's a good trick, really easy to use. Another trick is you should play up to your NPC's emotions and agendas. Now, depending on the game you play, your NPCs may have more or less importance. A game like Dungeons & Dragons will get your NPCs killed pretty fast or ignored. But that's one of the reasons. If you spent any effort on your NPC, you should play them out as much as you can. Not by taking screen time, but by making an impression on players. I recall playing this NPC who was the master of a house that the players had invaded. And as they went around the house before finding the NPC, I kept describing how the house was clean and spec-free. When the PC finally met the house's master and their servants, the first thing I had the master said says, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, the house is such a mess." The whole party broke up. It was just this one trait that I created out of the blue to make the house sound different. So you see, little things that you can play out pretty simply, and it really works. Another thing that came up in my games was that for some of my players, you need to keep your setting, your missions, believable. Now, we're not talking realism. We're talking about internal consistency. So, for example, in a game I used to play, there was this huge city growing inside a dungeon. It was called the Primal Witten Campaign. And it so happens that the PCs were always the only ones dealing with issues to help the city's leadership. But at a certain point, one of my players mentioned that how come the city leaders were leaders if they were never, ever able to deal with whatever it is that the players had to deal with all the time? And in this essence, he more or less said that if the adventurers were the only ones able to deal with problems, they should be leading the city, which gave me a choice. I either had to give them leadership of the city or make the leaders a little bit more competent. So you see, in order to get the players to focus on the adventure or to immerse themselves in your setting, you need to make things believable, or at least believable enough for them to buy it. Another thing that's really important is that you need to give your players difficult but meaningful choices in the adventures you design. So, for example, a very nice trick I like to use is give players two objectives. They need to seek out two different people that were kidnapped, or they need to explore a dungeon to recover two different artifacts. But make sure that both can't be recovered without having a significant cost in both reputation or leaving an important NPC behind, maybe an NPC that's one of the players, you know, love interest or family or something like that. So you basically split both objectives in two widely different ways, which means that the party can go after one without any difficulty, but they're leaving another behind with consequences. This usually makes the players send the evil eye your way, but it leaves a very strong emotional imprint that will make the game be remembered. In the same vein, make sure that the conflicts that you design in your adventures are dangerous. Players need to feel that there are things at stake. If they're combat conflicts, they need to feel that there's a good chance that they'll be bloodied or stand a chance of dying in those encounters. Or you could probably put some of those objectives we just talked about and mix them to a conflict encounter, saying basically giving the players a choice between going after the opposition physically and or saving one, probably maybe two of the objectives, but probably not do all three together. Finally, it's a good idea going outside of adventure design or the way you run the game to play in an environment where interruptions will be limited. I think it's very important that as a group, you discuss a common policy for cell phones, an electronic device around the table. Some people don't mind them, others do. It drives me up the wall to have a cell phone ring during a game, but other groups don't mind so much, so this you should address. The same thing goes with having friends or spouses, boyfriends, girlfriends interrupt during the game. I think that like a work task, a RPG session where focus has been achieved is as hard to get back into once focus is broken. So it'll take you about 10 to 15 minutes to go back into it afterwards. Now, if I am to look at my list of don'ts, and I didn't write a lot of them because I prefer to be positive than negative to achieve something cool in a RPG session, I still noted three of them down that are, in my opinion, pretty important. Now, the first one you shouldn't do, and really, it's really hard because I keep doing it after 30 years, is don't go meta on your players. What I mean by that is don't stop the game to explain what was behind the thinking when you designed that particular encounter. Don't stop the game to explain what you did in another game you DM'd where the same element happened and you made this particular calling. I know you're excited about the way you design your game and you would love to share with your players how crafty or clever you were when you created the encounter, but really, your players don't want to hear about that. Your players want to play the game, want to play out the adventure, and they don't want to be reminded, especially if they're immersed, that this is a construct. If you really need to share with your players what went behind the screen while you were designing your adventure, I suggest you do this after the adventure or between sessions. Next, while your players may break focus or immersion once in a while to talk about the latest movie, try really hard as a GM not to do it yourself. You're in charge of running the game, you're in charge of pacing, and while whatever happens at the table might remind you of a movie or something you saw that'd be cool to share, remember that if you stop the game and if you start talking about whatever went into your mind at that particular point, it'll take you 10 to 15 minutes bringing back the whole group into the same level of focus you had before. So, I mean, you can do it depending on how casual your group is and it's your own choice. But just realize the impact it has if you also want to have a focus group. Third, don't get caught in a rules argument or, heaven forbid, a debate against one of your rulings. You should allow each player to discuss for about 2 minutes how they think a ruling should go if they understand the rule at about the same levels as you do. But once those 1 or 2 minutes are gone and before the mood breaks around the table, make for a ruling and tell players that it can be discussed between the next two sessions so that a formal ruling can be done. Now, if players still want to argue and you risk really breaking the mood, I suggest that you call for a break so that the other players don't, and you leave with the players that need to discuss it so that the remaining players don't get involved in the discussion and the mood doesn't sour. Now, some groups really like arguing and it's part of their pleasures, but make sure that everybody agrees with that particular social dynamic. Mine doesn't, and it's been working pretty well so far. Now, the last don't is the most important. As a GM, you have to make sure that there is no dead time around the table. Now, dead time is time where you don't talk and nothing happens in terms of the game. So one of the ways I've seen this is when a DM stops the game and preps the next encounter. So I'm not saying that you should be prepared and have everything ready, but you should not create an encounter all piece while the players are waiting. You could call for a break again, have them go on a chips run, and doodle your encounter during that time, but just try not to have your players wait for something to happen. It will kill focus instantly, and getting it back will be hard. So, all in all these series of points should help you out achieve what I noticed in my games were more focused and more immersed game, which still, after 30 years, stand out through all the sessions I've played as the best ones we've played. Now, back to you guys.
Yeah, I know that I run into a lot of those issues with my group, and you know, I don't have the 30 years of experience under my belt quite yet. I do have a lot. I still run into those issues with my players, especially because I do allow laptops at the table, and I allow a certain amount of kind of off-topic stuff, but sometimes it goes awry, so those tips can really come in handy.
Then again, if your group is okay with that, I mean, some groups are more casual than others, but I've seen serious group unable to reach that particular focus and don't necessarily know why.
Yeah, well, as you say, it really is kind of a social contract sort of thing, as many of these issues are. I mean, I allow it to a certain point, but if it's really blocking the game or slowing things down, then, you know, I'll sometimes actually get upset, and that's when it's a problem, or I'll try to say, hey, can we not do this, you know?
But you do know that all your players actually use their phones and laptops to go on Twitter and say how bad a DM you are.
Yeah, right. No, they don't. I follow them all.
Yeah, there's that too. Your segment seems to tie a little bit into getting your players more into your campaign by providing some variety. So why don't you present it?
Let's say you're in the middle of a long-running campaign. The PCs in your game have conquered many foes, completed many quests, and in the case of D&D, gained many levels. They're happy with their characters, but at the same time, new books are coming out all the time. New classes, new races, new options. While your players may like the character they're playing, the wandering eye of the player may latch onto a new sexy character concept. Newbie DM suggested in a previous episode one answer to all this was with his Hall of Justice approach. This is great for groups that want to change characters often. However, some groups will just want to dabble with another character before returning to their main character, and DMs may want to keep continuity and players from adventure to adventure. For these groups, I recommend trying a flashback adventure. Take a bit of history in your campaign that hasn't fully been explored yet. Create a scenario that could fill in the details. Not so restrictive that the players can't make any meaningful decisions, but also not so open that the players' actions can disrupt your game's history completely. Though if they're anything like my players, they'll sure try. Get them to generate brand new characters of a level you set, though suggest a few characters that tie in, like a younger version of one of your main NPCs. Once you've got your cast, give them each motivations and goals. This is your chance to reveal some hidden twists about your campaign backstory and its NPCs by letting the players reveal them in-game. Then, run the game with this different set of characters in the area of history you want to fill in what happened. Thus, you have a flashback adventure, a different group in the past that still has ties to the present. It's a good idea to frame the adventure in a narrative technique that lets the current PCs use the knowledge gained from the flashback. It could be something involving powerful ritual magic that involves sight into the past, or something as simple as a story being told by another character. You also need to come up with a few backup plans in case the adventure goes really against what you've already established. This can involve an unreliable narrator, or it could just raise questions that you, the DM, will have to answer. Hey, if this guy died in the past, how did we meet him last week? Good question. Remember, this technique isn't just for players to try out new things either. It gives you more history to work off of when planning later adventures that you can throw callbacks into. Finding the grave of a fallen hero from long ago will have that much more meaning if one of the players actually played him, or was responsible for his death. Also, running at a much higher or lower level means you can try out new monsters, tricks, traps, even rules that you wouldn't otherwise be able to use, without too much fear that you'll wreck your ongoing campaign. Plus, you can run pre-written modules for other levels. The reason I thought of this technique was because the 4E version of Tomb of Horrors just arrived at my house. The adventure is written for 9th level characters, a minor 18th. But through a flashback, I can still run this classic adventure, and even have a TPK without it derailing my main campaign. Those are my tips for running a flashback adventure. If you use this technique or something similar in your games, please share.
Yeah, so that's my idea for running a flashback adventure. Again, as a player-focused thing, you know, maybe once in a while try this, and it can, in addition to the kind of benefits that I gave already, maybe invigorate your players a little bit more to play because they're trying out something new.
I really like this approach. It made me realize that you could use the flashback approach to, like, as you say, have players try other types of characters, and at the same time, use the idea that was proposed on Critical Hits, I think, last week, where you could have GMs switch in the same group and prepare a one-shot game in the same game world.
Yep, you absolutely could have someone else run an adventure of your game, so it gives you a chance to play too and try out a new character while everyone else is trying a new character and switching up the roles a bit. That would absolutely work too.
Yeah, you know, I'm definitively going to try this in the following year for sure. Cool, very cool tips. All right, we got some interesting email this month, so why don't we go read them and answer them?
Our first email is from Marduk. He says, "Greetings, how do you feel about mixing genres? One idea I would like to try is a D&D spy campaign, but I can't get anyone interested in playing it. Seems like a natural combination to me, what with all kinds of criminally oriented classes, skills, and powers, stealth, assassination, spying, impersonation, fraud, and confidence games. Magics for gadgets? Merlin would make a great cue." And he goes on to give a couple other examples. And yes, is mixing genres some kind of gaming taboo, or have I just been trying these ideas on the wrong people?
Well, I mean, when you really want to mix things up, the first ingredient for success is to get the whole group to actually accept doing it. And I noticed that a lot of role-playing groups are pretty conservative about what they expect or want to see around the table. Have you seen, have you got some, I'm going to ask a very obvious question because I know the answer with you, but do you mix genres a lot in your games?
Yeah, all the time. In fact, this would be my advice to Marduk. I think it's not taboo at all and, in fact, encouraged. It kind of depends on what extent you do it, but I would say my last, you know, four or five campaigns have all started with, you know, it's D&D, but with this genre attached. You know, you're still using all the D&D tropes and everything, but with one central kind of feel that you want to get in mind can really help drive the campaign.
What I think is really fundamental is when you want to mix genres is you need to think about it, doing it from the start when you start designing your setting or your campaign. I think your game mechanics should support the genre you want to play. So if you want to play spy game or if you want to play techno wizard, I think you need to go a little bit further than just fluffing the magic rules so that the wizard has a, you know, mechanical wand but actually plays out exactly as a normal wand. That's one of the things that I lived through using the Gears of War campaign is that even though it felt steampunkish for the monsters, it didn't felt at all for the players because if you're using the same mechanics.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's like what you're saying, it needs to be sort of stated up front where I think you can get away with it kind of once with mixing in some other genre if it's not set from the beginning. Like Expedition to Barrier Peaks is sort of the classic example.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you can have a D&D campaign and, okay, like one adventure is this weird alien spacecraft with technology and the players, you know, might get excited and they might roll their eyes, but, you know, as long as it's kind of contained in one adventure, it's not going to disrupt anything. But if you get to the point where too much of this stuff is kind of coming through, then your players might say, hey, are we actually playing this other kind of campaign? Did you pull a fast one on us? And that might lead to a problem. But I think some of the examples like your campaign that you're talking about or what the email says, you know, doing kind of a spy campaign, I don't think, you can sort of mean different things when you say genres.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, it's one thing to say, well, I'm going to have techno wizards and advanced technology in my D&D. Like, that's one level of genre mixing. But spy, you know, lends itself perfectly. My current campaign is actually sort of, I envisioned it as it being a team of investigators go on missions, but it's totally D&D, you know?
Yeah.
And my last campaign I envisioned as, like, revenge fantasy. So there's a more kind of plot slash theme ideas versus whole hog other genres.
Yeah, perfect. So basically you're talking about theme genres instead of the actual setting one.
Yeah, exactly. Setting genres versus theme genres. I think theme genres, like, you almost have to have them, while setting genres take a bit more work and people have different tolerances.
Yeah. And speaking of tolerances, I can't hear genres anymore. No, that's a joke. genres. All right, so we also have an email by Brian Murphy, right?
Yep. Brian Murphy says, I'm about to start running my first 4E campaign. One thing is I've noticed is a lot of talk about Paragon and Epic monsters are broken, don't work, have problems, etc. Fortunately, everywhere I go, the writer/poster seems to operate on the assumption that everyone already knows how they're broken, makes a vague mention of hit points or damage output. So I figured I'd ask you three, if the fundamental monster design math has changed, where can I find it, and what do you guys recommend watching out for when running Paragon and Epic Monsters from the Monster Manual 1, Monster Manual 2?
That's one of the features of discovering the online world of D&D is that you basically appear in the middle of discussions without actually having seen the beginning of those discussions. So I can understand and I can relate to Brian's confusion.
You miss like a week and then, you know, everything's changed.
Or rumors have exploded, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the big thing if you want to do it by the book and do a little more work is that one of the recent rules updates / errata / whatever you want to call them includes a new set of monster math that they've been using for Monster Manual 3 and other books forward.
Mm-hmm.
And those are generally increased and tweaked to be more in line. So that would be the absolute first place you could look. I know that Greg Bisland is one of the WotC guys, and he has a blog. He's talked about some of it. It's called Eye of the Beholder.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
Yep. And he's got a post that talks about the changes. And the one that really stuck out with me, he said, if you really don't want to bother with adjusting your monsters too much, you can just take, for Paragon and Epic monsters, whatever fixed bonus there is to damage, like if it's 2d8 plus 6, you just double that fixed bonus and make it 2d8 plus 12, and then you're good to go.
Yeah. And I mean, I think off the top of my head, the other tweaks were mostly, I think, upgrading the brute's attack bonus to be the same level as the other monsters, and probably cutting defense on soldiers and stuff like that by 2.
Yeah, I mean, oh, and solos are also another big
but
thing.
The solos
are a whole other issue.
Yeah. Yeah, the solos are another issue because the old solos were under-designed, or I don't know what's the proper expression, are not strong enough to deal with players once they're at that level of experience, both in playtime and the actual powers of the PCs.
Right. Yeah, so that would be the kind of high-level summary, is just increase damage, you know, tweak brutes and soldiers to kind of fall in line and avoid solos, and because, you know, there's a lot of good solos in later books, and you can also, like, solos, I kind of think, while it's a problem that they weren't really usable out of the box, you really want to spend more time making those monsters anyway. Because there generally should be more important story monsters, and so you might want to give them more abilities and tweak them to better fit your story and your players.
Yeah, perfect. Good fit. Very good tips. I hear that there's something next week called Gen Con, Dave.
I've never heard of it. Can you elaborate?
Never heard of it either, right? Is there any chance that... it's only rumors, but there's supposed to be a panel done by three Critical Hits DM. Would you by any chance know about that?
Huh, I did send a bunch of emails and whatnot scheduling that, so I guess I could say. So you and me and Chris Sims, also from Critical Hits, are going to be on a panel at 1 o'clock on Thursday of Gen Con called the 4E DMing Tips Panel. And we will dispense various DMing wisdom like we do on this here podcast. So be sure to check that out. You might have to get there a little bit early. I hear that tickets are completely sold out, but there may still be some adjustments. So swing on by and check us out.
It'll be a pleasure to talk to you, answer your questions, and try to be funny. All right. Well, this concludes our fourth show. We wish to thank you, the listener, for tuning in every time, and we hope you appreciate the various segments and content and tips that we give you. We also wish to thank our sponsor, Obsidian Portal, and we hope to see you soon when we come back from Gen Con. We recuperate from everything, and we'll have lots of stuff to tell you about.
So if you have questions that you want us to answer, you can send us an email to dmg@critical-hits.com. You can leave a comment on any of the posts of the podcast by going to dmguys.net or going to critical-hits.com and clicking on the podcast tab, and you'll see in the drop-down Dungeon Master Guys. Or you can leave us a voicemail using Newbie DM's line at 305-349-3026. That's 305-349-3026. Be sure to say it's for the DM Guys podcast.
Don't hesitate to leave us messages. We love to answer questions. And with that, we conclude our show. I'll see you at Gen Con, Dave.
I will be there. As a newbie and any number of our other blogging friends.
We'll be back with lots of stories and new ideas to share with you.